Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I am joined once again, I believe, by my most frequent guest. Fourth time guest, Marisa is telling me. Marisa McClellan, longtime listeners will recognize her as my lovely wife. Marisa, thank you for joining.
I'm so glad to be here.
Tell the people a little bit about yourself, Marisa.
Well, I'm married to you.
Yes, I already covered that.
I am a cookbook author. Yeah. My fourth cookbook will be out very soon.
And this is not why we're recording this, but it is actually a good reason. Tell us a little bit about this new cookbook of yours.
It's called The Food in Jars Kitchen, and it is all about cooking with preserves like jams and pickles and chutneys and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I've written a bunch of canning cookbooks, and now it's time to show people how to use everything I've taught them to make.
What's your favorite recipe from the book?
I really love the jam lacquered chicken wings.
Oh.
You don't like chicken wings, so I haven't made them for you, but they are quite delicious.
What is my favorite recipe from the book?
The crab cakes.
Oh, I do enjoy a crab cake.
I know.
Is that why you included it in the book, because I like crab cakes?
No, I mean, I also put a healthy dose of pickles in them, but they are your favorite.
Do you put pickles in the crab cakes that I eat?
Yes, every time.
Oh. I don't like pickles by themselves, but I like pickles in things.
Well, that's why you like my crab cakes.
There you go. Foodinjars.com is where people should go to check out your work.
And if they like listening to me, they could also listen to my podcast, which is called Local Mouthful.
Oh,
it doesn't have nearly the listenership that Random Trek here does.
Well, you lack my magnetic personality.
It's true. But it's a podcast that I co-host with my friend Joy, and we do a half an hour once a week on what we're cooking and things you can make for dinner and some food trends and just interesting things about food and cooking.
What's your favorite food trend as of late? Or what's the hottest food trend? It doesn't have to be your favorite.
Well, one food trend that I'm really enjoying is the Instant Pot craze.
Oh,
you know, I love
on an Instapot craze.
It's true.
Late breaking news. The Instapot company has been purchased or merging with the people that make Pyrex.
Oh, really?
Pyrex or Corningware. I think it's Pyrex.
Oh, well, I think they're part of Corningware.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yes. You didn't, you see? So two great tastes.
Well, I have always been a fan of pressure cooking as well as pressure canning. And so I really love the Instant Pot because it allows you to not have to worry about your stove temperature. And with our ancient stove, I always worried about that, so it all works out.
And we have two Instant Pots.
We did. For a brief period of time, we had three, but that was too many.
We have a big one and a little one.
Yep.
So my final food-related question.
Yes.
Is what is your favorite use for the Instant Pot, barring hard-boiled eggs? Because that is what you use it probably the most for.
It's true. I do hard-boiled eggs weekly in the Instant Pot. I
ate a lot of hard-boiled eggs.
I think the other thing I really love is making like chicken stock or vegetable stock in the Instant Pot.
Because that takes a long time outside of the Instant
Pot. Well, and you also get a really clear stock when you do it in the Instant Pot because the action of boiling makes the stock cloudy. But in an Instant Pot, it doesn't actually boil because it goes above the boiling point.
What?
So you get something that's really crystal clear, and I love that.
What kind of food magic is this?
Pressure cooking food magic.
So things in pressure cookers don't boil?
No.
This is blowing my mind.
Well,
this is why you can make all kinds of crazy stuff in the Instant Pot.
Like what kind of crazy stuff?
Like cheesecake?
I guess. I hadn't really thought about that, but it does make sense.
Oh, see?
Yeah, look at you.
Put two together. but we're not here to talk about food.
No.
Or your forthcoming cookbook coming out April 2nd called The Food in Jars Kitchen. Buy it in your local grocery stores, probably not grocery stores, your finer bookstores.
Yes.
Probably even the crappier bookstores in your area.
Chances are good.
If you have bookstores in your area anymore. If not, your favorite purveyor of online books. No, your favorite online purveyor of books.
There we go.
I won't mention any, but you have one that you're thinking about. So just go there. They all have it.
It's true.
Or they all will have it. You could even pre-order it now.
My publisher would love it if you pre-ordered it.
There you go. And if you leave a review on Amazon, that's great too. Or Barnes & Noble, wherever.
Yeah,
Just buy the book.
Powell's.
Powell's, you should go to, you're from the Pacific Northwest.
I am.
So, buy Powell's, go to Powell's, The Strand, which is an East Coast bookstore.
Your home
bookstore.
That's
my home bookstore. Or your local bookseller.
That's right.
Of choice. And then while you're there, you could buy Dan Morin's book. You could look for a copy of my books, but they're a waste of your money, so don't do it. 5 years ago, they may not have been a waste of your money, but they're all tech books, so don't bother looking for them. Anyway, So let's talk about the episode that we're supposed to talk about. Now, normally, the premise of this show is that it is a random episode and a non-random guest. But I'm gonna let the listeners peek behind the curtain and come up front and say that the episode we watched today, which is Body Parts, Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 25, was not random.
No, we picked it.
We picked it purposefully for a very particular reason in this episode. This is the episode that people know, most likely, spoiler alert, Keiko O'Brien is pregnant. There is a horrible accident, and Kira Nerys has to, through, and we'll get to it when we're talking about this, has to carry the O'Brien's baby to term, which she does. So the baby's fine, everybody. Don't worry. Now, Marisa, why did we watch this episode in particular?
We watched this episode because we're having two babies.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God.
Marisa is pregnant.
It is true.
With twins.
Yes.
One of which is a boy.
The other one, we don't know.
It could be a dribble or a Klingon.
We have a big problem if it's Klingon.
That's true. It is not a Klingon. Because Klingons are fictional.
You are not a Klingon.
I am not a Klingon. It is true. So yes, that's why. Yes. I thought it would be fun. We haven't announced this anywhere other than podcasts currently.
It's true.
Because Marisa, as mentioned before, has a podcast called Local Mouthful. She announced it on that podcast. We have told, of course, all our family and the people who need to know. So now the Random Trek audience gets to find out through, I don't know if you care, but that's the reason why we're doing it. The episode is, and so you've seen this episode before.
I have. Yes.
Did this episode, now that you have not previously been pregnant, these are our first children.
Yes.
And our last children. just to clear that up.
Yes. Oh, believe me, I'm aware of that.
So was the experience different watching it as a pregnant person versus being not pregnant?
I certainly think that it is. You know, one of the weird, like when you are pregnant, you realize that, you know, you think a lot about how, like, you know, every person on the planet, this is how they come. Like, this is how they get here. They have to come through someone else's body to get here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had always kind of just, in watching this episode, suspended disbelief and been like, oh, you know, great. They can transplant the babies from, or her baby from one womb to another. Mm-hmm. And now that I have two small people mm-hmm. in my lower abdomen, one, there are moments when I think, gee, it'd be great if someone else could carry them for a little while. But also just, it's such a personal process that I both the O'Briens in the episode seem to really struggle with it because mm-hmm. it's their baby and suddenly they don't have any control or contact with it. But, you know, also just the kind of violation that one would feel to have that happen to them. And certainly Keiko is a little bit emotional and sad, but I would expect a great deal more kind of trauma reaction from her because mm-hmm. that would be a really traumatic experience.
Well, she was in sickbay for a little while, so one assumes they fixed her trauma.
You know, Star Trek on a whole doesn't do real well with trauma or like emotional stuff. Like there's sometimes some episodes that deal with it, but on a day-to-day basis, I feel like they don't really address emotional health very much.
And I looked to see who wrote this episode because, so the reason this episode, this is a good episode, by the way, I think. The reason this episode exists in the form that it does is because the actress or actor, we're not supposed to say actress anymore, non-gendered nouns, please, actor, Nana Visitor, I'm not sure how she says it, was pregnant. And the father of that child, Dr. Bashir. Alexander Siddig, I believe is how he says his name. Yes, they married briefly, I think,
yeah.
And then they got a divorce. But that's neither here nor there. So she was pregnant, and they were like, well,
how do we deal with this?
You're still going to be in Deep Space Nine, so I read they had three options that they could think of. They do the old kind of 50s, 60s, 70s way of doing it, which is Kira just is always sitting at a desk, or she's behind a potted plant, or whatever, and they hide her pregnant belly.
I remember on The Cosby Show in the 80s, they did some crazy things to cover Felicia Rashad's pregnancy. I remember once she was sitting behind like a 6-foot teddy bear fixing a hole in its head. So like that is a well-traveled trope.
And now they would just, one assumes, digitally remove it. They probably, that's probably what they do when they don't want to write in a pregnancy into an episode or into a series. So they could do that. They didn't want to do that because they thought it was stupid.
Yeah.
They could have Kira be pregnant by her love interest at the time, whose name I can't remember. Shakar? Is that Shakar? Or was that...
I think this is the Shakar era, yes.
Bajoran holy man. Or do what they did here, which is some kind of science fiction-y thing to explain it away. And they came upon this solution, which I thought is an interesting solution. And it makes me wonder, because Dr. Bashir, so there's an accident. Dr. Bashir, Keiko, and Kira are on a runabout, and they went to some planet or something for some botany reason. I don't know. Keiko was excited. Miles O'Brien, less excited. But Keiko is doing it herself. This is her second pregnancy. She's wants to scale mountains and dangle off cliffs to get fungus, and she's going to do it. People we have spoken to have said that the first pregnancy, you're very worried as the person carrying this little person, as you are. You know this. But your second pregnancy, it's kind of like old hat. Been there, done that. I can get away with more. So I know what's going to happen. So Keiko, this is their second child. So she's kind of like, you know, lighten up, Miles. I'm going to leave my life.
Laissez-faire.
Exactly. But Miles kind of turns out to be right, because she's in this horrific runabout accident where she's knocked unconscious and her ribs are broken and she suffers bodily trauma. And luckily she's with Julian Bashir, who is you may have opinions about his character, but he's the one thing we know about him that is indisputable is that he's a very good doctor.
Yes.
And so he takes her baby and puts it into Kira. And they're kind of like, how is that even possible? And Dr. Bashir is like, well, you know, I had to do some stuff and now we can't take it out. Because that's the other question. Like the big problem is now it's weird that it's in Kira, but if you could put it into Kira, can't you take it out of Kira and put it back into Keiko?
Yeah. And he makes this whole explanation about how Bajoran women, they only gestate for 5 months. And so their vascular system sort of integrates with the fetus really quickly. The other thing he said that I thought was really interesting is that he had to kind of boost her system by giving her a lot of estrogen and progesterone. Mm-hmm. And as someone who spent 10 weeks getting progesterone shots and just experiencing the natural flow of estrogen, all I could think is, holy heck, how was she feeling?
Oh, dear. That's true. I mean, that's the other thing we don't have to talk about, we're going to, though, is that our babies are twins. Twins do not run in our families whatsoever. But we are the proponents, or we used IVF. I don't know if we're proponents of it, but...
Well, we did it.
It worked.
Yeah, we adopted a little high-tech science.
Exactly. It's kind of Star Trek science fiction, or science, because it's real, to make our babies happen.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool.
But you went through multiple days and weeks of getting shots of progesterone. So
yes.
When I first listened or watched this episode, I had no idea what progesterone was. And when Dr. Bashir says it, I was like, oh, that's the thing I've been shooting into you.
Yes, you are well versed in progesterone these days.
That's true. And I'm really good. If anyone out there needs someone to inject them with something that is legal, I don't want to support any non-legal injections. I'm pretty good at injecting stuff now. So
you are.
If you need it. Although I can't find veins, because progesterone is, the difficulty isn't, you just stick it in there and
it
it's
just
fine.
Just went into my butt.
Find a vein. But so I was thinking about this because there's this whole kind of rich vein of technology and science fiction around kind of this birth process that is largely ignored in science fiction, because for the best part of 50, 60 years, science fiction has been largely written by men, largely written for men. Now, that's not to say that women haven't written lots of science fiction. They have, nor is that to say that women don't enjoy science fiction, because they do. I'm just saying, historically, in broad strokes, that is kind of where we are.
The only person who's really addressed it in an interesting way, were you about to say this?
Yes.
Was Louise McMaster Bujold in the Vorkosigan books, which the uterine replicators are this really interesting science that she develops for that series of books, and they play a large role throughout the series.
And this episode made me think of that, because I think that this is, as you said before, this is how everybody gets here. So you would think that there would be more kind of science fiction around this, and I'm sure there are lots of things that I am unaware of, but in kind of big science fiction franchises, pregnancy and birthing and what happens with artificial wombs and artificial kind of reproduction with humans is not really a big thing. There's cloning and that kind of thing, but... So I thought it was interesting. But it made me think that... So it seemed to me that Julian rather easily did this.
Yes.
Because he was on a runabout. He didn't have his whole lab with him. And it did not... It worked, which is good. But it was from one species to another, not even the same species, which would seem like would make it easier. So it makes me wonder if in Star Trek land, when women are pregnant, if they can just like move, like, could you just have a, is there someone in the Federation that, much like we have here, we have surrogates, right?
Yeah.
In the real world. So is surrogacy even bigger because there are people that can, you can
easily
just move your babies around?
Maybe. Although I'm sure that that would raise issues of, you know, is it that women from like emerging societies are the ones who are serving as
like breeding tanks?
Uh-huh. I mean, it's certainly an interesting road that someone could explore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's got to be some sort of Star Trek fan fiction.
Or just science fiction in general.
Yeah.
Exploring probably the more horrific side of that.
Yeah.
Because that can, I didn't even think of that, but it could lead to bad things happening.
Well, in the Jasper Ford book that we both just read, Early Riser, it seems like there's this whole cast of nuns whose job is, you know, exclusively to be essentially human breeding ground.
That's true. And then they raise the children in kind of group homes.
Yeah.
And then at some point, I guess when they're a certain age, they get adopted or something like that.
Yeah, because the winters are so harsh that like a third of the population die, and so you got to keep replenishing.
Exactly. And why get attached when the kid is going to die? So you wait until they've proved of hardy stock, and then you bring them into your house. That Jasper Ford. Although you didn't really like that book, did you? Or did you come around to it?
I came around to it. I really wanted it to be a little less like some of his young adult fiction, and like the tropes felt very similar. So.
But that's not,
anyway.
That's neither here nor there. Although related to the whole birthing thing, so let's finish up the Keiko O'Brien.
I derailed it.
No, that's fine. It's a conversation, Marisa. We'll finish up. So there's an A plot and a B plot. Interestingly, I think the more interesting plot is the B plot, which is Keiko and Kira's switching babies.
Yeah.
Which is necessary because they want, as we said before, Nana Visitor to continue to remain on the show. So Keiko is recuperating. Miles and Keiko have to kind of come to grips with the fact that now Keiko is no longer pregnant, but their son is still fine, but he is now inside of Kira and Aris. And Kira needs to come to grips with the fact that she is now, she's kind of, I guess she volunteered to do it at the time, right? Because that's what you do.
Yeah.
But I don't know if she really thought through the entire kind of responsibility that she would have. Because by the end of the episode, basically, Keiko and Miles talk about how that, you know, they're very grateful that Kira did this. And Dr. Bashir feels bad, but when he tells Captain Sisko, Captain Sisko says, you made the right choice, right? But there, Keiko obviously is like, I don't want to be away from my baby. It's weird that I am not involved in the process anymore,
yeah.
Which I can understand. And so they have Kira come over for dinner. Or actually, she just drops by to visit. And then they're like, oh, why don't you stay for dinner? And so she stays for dinner. And then they have this interesting scene where they're like, we want to talk to you about something. And then they cut away. And we don't actually see the conversation. But basically, their conversation is, you should move in with us. Which is, on the one hand, makes complete sense because pregnant ladies need help. And Kira has never been pregnant before. So she might be sneezing up a storm, which is apparently the Bajoran equivalent of morning sickness. Although sneezing sounds more pleasant to me than being nauseous all the time. But also kind of weird.
Definitely a little weird. You know, especially since Kira, in most of this, the run of this show, is very independent. She values her independence. She values her autonomy. And then suddenly she's like, sure, I'll move in with you.
I'll move in and take all the help I can get. Although now that we're going to be parents of twins, I have been throughout my life kind of doggedly independent, as you can attest to, I am sure. Some might say stubbornly independent in many aspects of my life. But I'm going to open up my heart and my home to anyone who wants to help. You can help. Listeners, if you're in Philadelphia and you want to help out somehow, feel free, because it's going to be crazy pants.
Yeah.
So I think that also Kira's like, well, I don't know, I've never done this before. It's nice to have this kind of support network. And Molly is there, and she says, are you my aunt now? And she's like, Keiko and Miles are like, I guess so. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And that's... Well, and on the flip side, you know, Kira hasn't had a whole lot of family since
they're all dead.
The war. So I can see how this would, you know, and she's certainly got all those hormones pumping.
That's true.
So maybe she's feeling this need for family and
maternal instinct
connection.
And it'll be interesting. I mean, they obviously for the rest of this season and I think the beginning of the next season, because this is late in season four, but I don't know when she gives birth. But they revisit this storyline and they talk about, you know, because I think as being someone who cannot be pregnant and so never will be, one imagines, and I don't know how surrogates handle this, but you carry this baby that isn't yours and you're going through all these hormones that are designed to make you feel very protective and make sure that you protect the baby and do all the right things. And then you have to give it up because it's not yours.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
And so that must be very difficult in fiction and in real life. So I don't know how she would handle that.
I don't know. I don't remember how she... And I feel like that it becomes a subplot in some of them.
Yes, I think she's... Yeah. Well, and they live very close to one another, so it's kind of like she's like their...
It's true.
I suppose, so she shows up. But that's really... I mean, the end with her moving in, and they're surprised. The O'Briens are surprised that she doesn't have much stuff. But she says,
Well, I mean, she still has her quarters, so it's true. Not
she
like
she... hasn't given up her quarters. Yes. One imagines. So she has a satchel or something that she comes with. And I imagine Kira, given her background, doesn't have a lot of knickknacks.
Yeah, she strikes me as someone who travels light.
I think she's ready to leave at any moment, just in case the Cardassians come back and she needs to wage guerrilla warfare.
True.
But interestingly, the bulk of this episode, this is more of a Ferengi episode than it is a pregnancy episode.
It's true. And yet there's some interesting themes about life, I guess. That's what they use to tie these together.
Yes, body parts and life. And yeah, so Quark is starts off the show in a very happy mood. We don't know why. He's being very nice to Rom, which is unusual. And we quickly find out that Quark is dying. And then he has six or seven days to live. And he's very sad about it. But Rom points out that he has a great opportunity to follow the wonderful Ferengi tradition of desiccating his corpse and selling, I guess, 52 discs of his desiccated corpse to the highest bidders.
To pay off his debt, because he can't die without paying off his debts.
He can't die without paying off his debts to Ferengi.
Yes.
Which is very important, because some number rule of acquisition is a contract is a contract is a contract. As long as it's between Ferengi. So he can die owing Klingons and humans money, but he can't die owing Ferengi money. And this episode, I mean, they're building this up, right? So that contracts are important, but only because for Ferengi. And Quark really likes being a Ferengi. His identity is that he is a Ferengi businessman, not that he is a family man, because he doesn't have a son, but his brother.
And a nephew.
And not that he's just a businessman, but he is a Ferengi businessman. So that's important, right? And Quark is like, no one's going to buy. I'm a failure. I'm just this. I'm a laughingstock on Ferenginar. No one's going to buy my cut up corpse, which is an interesting idea. But Rom says, well, you might as well give it a try. And so Rom, Quark does, and there's a Ferengi's future market for desiccated corpse discs, which the episode leads me to believe that it takes like three taps to list your body on the Ferengi corpse future market, because that's what Quark does. And he gets one kind of lowball offer that is from Rom, because Rom, although Quark treats Rom very poorly, Rom is very nice to Quark.
It's true.
But then, out of the blue, is a very high bid on Quark's remains that will wipe out all his debts and leave him a little extra money to pay for his funeral and all the things that one wants. So he takes it, and it turns out to be Quark's longtime nemesis. Brunt, played by Jeffrey Combs, who plays Wayoon and a bunch of other, an Andorian, Sharn on Enterprise. He comes up all over the place. And so the point of this is that Quark is dying. We who watch this know that Quark is not dying. And it turns out that Dr. Bashir gets a message from the very expensive. Oh, there's another thing that keeps kind of cropping up in this episode that I thought was funny. So Quark goes to Ferenginar, has a great time, sees a bunch of Ferengi. Goes to a Ferengi doctor because the Ferengi doctors are the best. And he finds out that he's got this syndrome that's going to kill him in 7 days. Rom says, well, why don't you get a second opinion? And you could go talk to Dr. Bashir and he could check him out. And Quark says, well, what would a human know about Ferengi physiology? Plus, this doctor on Ferenginar is the most expensive doctor, which means that he is the most accurate doctor. Dr. Bashir doesn't even charge anything, so what would he know? So I thought that was interesting. And that comes up again in some context. I don't remember what they're talking about, some expensive thing that must be the best because it's the most expensive thing. And I can't remember what it was, but...
I don't remember, but yeah.
But it comes up. So that's the point of the episode, of course, is that just because you spend a lot of money on something doesn't mean it's the best thing or the most accurate. And one could imagine that it is a gentle jibe at the American health system. But I don't know if that's true or not. So don't write me angry emails if you agree or disagree with that. Read what you will into it. But long story short, Quark's not dying. But a contract is a contract is a contract between Ferengi. So Brunt bought Quark's remains and he shows up on Deep Space Nine. Determined to, in 6 days, 6 days' time, get his remains. And Quark says, oh, well, I guess you didn't hear. I'm not dying. It's great. I'll give you a refund. I'll give you, with interest. And it turns out Brunt doesn't really want the money, which is not very Ferengi of him.
No.
He just wants Quark to die.
He just hates Quark because, essentially, from a human standpoint, Quark is actually a pretty good person.
Quark is still a bad person.
He is,
but he is good for he's a good person as a Ferengi.
Yes, I thought that the litany of things that Brunt accuses Quark of as being a bad Ferengi were like, well, that kind of makes him a good person. He when the war was on, he sold medicines to the Bajorans at cost, and then he says, "Well, a little bit above cost,
but have to make a little profit." I think that Quark is an interesting character because he wants to be true to himself and he really likes being a Ferengi, but he also wants to, despite his own self-interest, he wants to help people. And there are two things that we know about Quark that are kind of his defining characteristics, but that don't actually define him. He is a coward and he is greedy. But when push comes to shove and he needs to help his friends, his true character comes out and he's not completely greedy or a complete coward, but he is always self-serving.
True. I thought, I think it's interesting if you look at the flip side of like looking at the version of Quark that exists in the Mirror Universe and how it's like push has come to shove so much that he is entirely the good version of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you can see the spectrum that he exists on throughout the entire run of Deep Space Nine.
Yes, that's true. And that's what makes, and I've talked about, I think this with you and with many people when we're talking about Deep Space Nine, that's what makes Deep Space Nine my favorite Star Trek series that is complete. Discovery is not complete yet, so I don't know where it ranks in the pantheon of Star Trek series just yet. But the fact that, you know, I love Star Trek, the original series, TNG, but the characters pretty much from the first season to the last season, they don't really change or grow a whole lot. Everything kind of resets. From the first season of Deep Space Nine to the last season of Deep Space Nine, the characters, Quark included, are very different than they were at the beginning of Deep Space Nine in meaningful ways.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode is a perfect example of that because it's basically, It's a Wonderful Life, Quark.
yes.
Because Quark is really down in the dumps. He's dying. He thinks he's a failure. Because in Ferengi, you know, kind of the way they reckon things, he is a failure. He's just a bartender on a Federation outpost. He's the king of Synthahol, I think they call him. So he's with this do-good organization and he's helping people. He gives his staff vacation time,
which they pay into,
which they pay for. But still, he only takes 30% of their tips. He does all of these things that make him kind of, in Ferengi eyes, a chump, but in everyone else's eyes, less bad.
Yeah.
But still not great. But he also thinks, I don't have any assets. I don't have any friends.
He doesn't care about friends.
He thinks of them as assets and that no one will help him and no one cares about him. No one's going to buy his remains because he's a failure. But he has this contract with Brunt, right? So he needs to, he can't break it because Rom basically says, well, just break the contract. You're not dying. He won't take the money back, so just break the contract. And Quark says, well, that's something you would do because you're not a real Ferengi, but I can't. So his solution is to get Garak to kill him. which leads to a good scene where Garak kills a holographic version of Quark by breaking his neck. And Quark says, oh, I don't want that to be the last thing I hear. And then Garak goes through a list of ways that he's previously tried to kill the holographic version of Quark. And Quark has rejected all of them for a variety of reasons.
I love the zeal in Garak's eyes when Quark asked him to kill him. Like there was, it's just light, he lit up.
And then, yes, it comes to the point where Quark is like, well, I don't want to see it coming. And Garak says, well, so you're telling me you want to be surprised by your death? And Quark's like, yes, exactly. I want to be alive at one moment and then waking up in the Great Exchange the next. And Garak says, well, that can be arranged. And then there's the funny scene where now Quark is just on edge saying, I'm expecting to die every time he walks into a room so he won't get killed because he really doesn't want to die. But he has to for this contract. So to make basically he has a dream that convinces him not to kill, pay himself. To kill, have himself killed because he's too much. He won't kill himself. Which is a topic rife, so we won't even talk about that. but he will. It's a very Ferengi thing, though. He doesn't want to kill himself, but he will pay someone to kill him.
It's outsourcing.
Exactly. It's an act of commerce. But he cancels that contract. He also cancels the contract with Brunt and says, basically, not doing it. To which Brunt, who is a member of the Ferengi Business Council or something, I forget what it's called.
Trade Council.
Shuts down his business.
Takes everything he has.
Takes all of his assets and forbids any Ferengi from working for or doing business with Quark. And so then they open up. The next scene is a very sad scene with Quark and Rom sitting in an empty bar, bereft of booze and furniture, and Quark basically being like, this is my life now. I'm a failure. And then Dr. Bashir comes in with some brandy that he was paid for, a process or a procedure like some patient gave him. And he said, well, I can't take it. So do you want it, Quark? And Quark says, I know what you're doing and I don't want your charity. And Dr. Bashir says, well, I just don't like it either. I don't want to keep it. So you either take it or I pour it out. And so he takes it. And then Dax comes in and with some ugly glasses and says, my sister gave me these ugly glasses and I don't want them, but I thought maybe you could use them. To which Rom says, they are ugly, but they're not as ugly as our old glasses. So they take them. And then Sisko comes in and says, you know, we're doing some renovation on the upper pylons and we have all this furniture and it needs to go somewhere. Can we store it in here? And this is the moment when Quark realizes, or I think Rom says, see, these are your assets. And Quark realizes he has friends. And so he takes the furniture. Obviously, this is the It's a Wonderful Life end moment where all the people in, what is the name of that town? I can't think of the name of the town they live in.
Bedford Falls.
Bedford Falls come in, and George Bailey's the luckiest, the richest man in Bedford Falls, even though he's not, because he has friends. And so Quark is like, yay, hooray. But of course, he, in traditional Quark, he can't accept it. So he says to Captain Sisko, you can store your furniture here, but you have to pay a nominal storage fee, which I thought was funny. And very true to Quark's character. And that's the lesson at the end is that everybody has friends.
That it pays to have friends.
It pays to have friends, exactly. Yeah. It's very selfish.
Yes.
And in two ways, right? It pays to have friends because they can help you out of this jam when you don't want to die. But they can also carry your baby for you if you need to. Because these are both, I mean, orders of magnitude difference, but kind of selfless acts of trying to help someone in need. So I guess that's the real theme of the episode is you got to have friends.
It's true.
Or else your baby will die and your business is going to go bust.
Yeah, I guess that is the...
I guess, just to boil it down.
But it's a good episode and it's a, you know, some... It moves, and you know, unlike some Star Trek episodes, like it's entertaining as well as sort of, you know, giving us a little bit of extra, you know, view into the characters in our lives. So, I mean, I like this one.
Yes, and it has a bunch of great lines. I enjoyed particularly when Quark is thinks that the Grand Nagus has bought his desiccated remains because they're friends, and Rom says, well, he uses you when it's convenient for him, but I don't think that makes you friends.
Yeah.
But I said that was funny.
There is a lot of honesty, sort of disguised as humor in this episode.
It is very true.
Which is kind of fun.
And so what kind of mother do you think Kira Nerys would make?
That's a good question. I think that she would be an uncomfortable mother at first. Like if she was carrying a baby that she was unexpected to care for, that, you know, that a lot of her kind of nurturing instincts may have been sort of, those were not the things that allowed you to survive during the war. And so those were not parts of her character that were really cultivated. And so I think that she would struggle to reconnect with those aspects of herself. And she never, like, I still have like 10 episodes of the last season to watch. I have been holding on to it because I don't want it to end. And so I don't remember, I don't know what like her, she's with Odo.
By the end, yes. Spoiler alert.
Sorry.
It's 25 years old, right?
You know, that raises a whole other host of issues about reproduction.
Yes.
But she is a more sort of nurturing character by the end of the series, in part because she has allowed herself to love and be loved in a way that she had never done before.
That's true.
So I can see her being a better and more comfortable mother by the end of the series rather than at this point.
And she, much like Quark, who kind of rejects having these relationships and wants to frame them all in kind of commerce to distance himself because he doesn't want to be rejected, is I think really what it comes down to. Kira, in the beginning of the episode, the series, distanced herself from everyone because she doesn't want to be hurt because everyone she knows and loves has been killed by the Cardassians. So, and she's just there to do a job and she's not interested in, you know, she's interested in camaraderie because that's kind of what she knew, but she's not interested in any kind of deeper connections. And then throughout the course of the the season, both of them become enmeshed in the lives of others. Kira, very clearly here in this episode, very directly enmeshed in the O'Brien's life. Yeah,
enmeshed.
Exactly. She's her veins are all up in there, baby.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, just from like a, they don't get into this, obviously, but I wonder if that baby would be born with some Bajoran DNA, because there's this inevitable transfer.
I don't know if they talk about that or not.
You know, it would be interesting. Anyway.
That would be interesting. So my final question.
Yes.
Is, so you will be, I don't know when motherhood technically begins. I guess you're technically a mother now, right? Because you got babies in you. But the babies are not out. Aside, yes, capering about
independent gestating
organisms. But what trait would you take from Kira Nerys and hope to see in your own kind of mothering, if any?
That's an interesting question.
I thought so.
Well, I think that I often, throughout the series, I appreciate Kira Nerys's sort of no-nonsense attitude, that she can really cut to the meat of the matter and not let the kind of side stuff get in the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm someone who can get distracted by the details pretty easily. And I actually think that this is where you and I function well together, is that I can get lost in the details or the emotion of something, and you can say, this is what you need to do. And there have been many times, like, if something goes wrong with my blah, I mean, it's like, obviously children and a website are two different things.
Well, Food in Jars is your baby.
It's true. It's my, you know, my books and my blog have been my first sort of creations. And so sometimes when things go wrong or someone says something mean,
someone says something mean on the internet.
I know, shocking, right?
People have said mean things about this very podcast.
I think the hard thing for me about people being mean is people are not often mean about canning.
Oh, well, that's true.
You know? And so when someone says something mean to me, I am not prepared for it, because most of the time when we're talking about canning and food preservation, it's a pretty sort of congenial atmosphere. Mm. So then when someone whips out that, you know, like rapier, I'm not prepared.
Oh, dear.
But I think that would be something that I could really use a little bit more of in my own character, is ability to not get tangled in the emotion or the sort of the, like, have that stress reaction and be able to see things a little more clearly. And I imagine for Kira, for that character, grant you, she's fictional.
True.
But the experience in wartime really cultivates that kind of behavior, right, where you can't let your emotions cloud your judgment. You just have to do what's in front of you.
Mm-hmm. You have to make split-second decisions to save people's lives, and your own life, one imagines.
Yeah, and I have never been in a war zone, so
neither have I.
That is not a skill set that I have ever developed.
But we're about to, well, not about, it's still a ways away, but not a huge way away.
Yes.
We're about to enter the
a personal war zone.
Perilous war zone known to humanity, having twins. But I think that we will be victorious.
I think so. We're going to survive this, Scott.
That's right. And future us, if we're listening to this, I don't know why we would be. Let us know how we did. And if our children are listening, which I doubt they would be, go to bed. Be more respectful. And
eat your vegetables.
Eat your vegetables. That's right. Well, Marisa, thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure.